You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Greetings from WCPT in Chicago, from the brand new studios of our progressive affiliate here in Chicago. Tomorrow I'm going to be speaking along with Governor Quinn to the President's Day annual hoop-de-doop for DuPage County Democrats over at Drury Lane and the Oak Brook Terrace. So it's should be a fun day, and got on the plane early this morning, and I'm here now. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie day, of course, it being Friday, and time for our national town hall meeting with the guy I think of as America's senator. Hey, Bernie, how are you?
I'm great, Tom. How are you?
Just fine, thank you. Oh, and I should say to our viewers, by the way, there's no video of me right now because my computer crashed. I'm hoping it's going to come back up, although we do have audio, fortunately. But I think people could see you. So what's going on?
Well, there's a lot that's going on, and let me just tick off some of the issues. Yesterday, I was at a budget committee hearing. I'm a member of the budget committee with Tim Geithner, Secretary of the Treasury, and we had an interesting discussion, Republicans, Geithner, and myself. And the point that I try to make is I get sick and tired of hearing right-wing Republicans claiming that they are the deficit hawks. And they claim they're the great deficit hawks because they are prepared to cut Social Security, cut Medicare, cut Medicaid, cut education, cut environmental protection, cut any and every program that benefits working families. That makes them a deficit hawk. But what I reminded them is these are the guys who voted for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and forgot to pay for them. And that bill will end up running us somewhere around $3 trillion by the time we take care of the last veteran. That's not being a deficit hawk. These guys voted for huge tax breaks for the wealthiest people in this country. That's not being a deficit hawk. These are the guys who voted to deregulate Wall Street so that the crooks there can engage in all kinds of phony transactions, which resulted in the collapse of Wall Street and the recession and the significant decline of revenue. That's not being a deficit hawk. Voting not to have a Medicare negotiate drug prices with the pharmaceutical industry and Medicare Part D is not being a deficit hawk. So I think, Tom, it's very important that we not give these guys the mantle of being deficit hawks. They're the ones, to a significant degree, who has caused the deficit problem. And now what they want to do, having caused the problem, is cut every single program for the elderly, the children, the middle class, the sick. And we got to stand up to them and not give them the mantle of being deficit hawks. That's an issue.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, just a point of fact, after the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln, we saw a 1,500% increase in our national debt. He got us out of that by putting into place an income tax and by growing us out of it. After World War II, we were at 127% of GDP in debt. We grew our way out of it by Truman and Eisenhower building highways and roads and schools and putting young men to, mostly men, young returning vets from World War II, sending them to college for free. We grew our way out of it.
Absolutely. And the issue is that right now, when real unemployment is closer to 15% than it is to 8.2%, counting those who have given up looking for work and people who are working part-time, we need a massive jobs bill to put our people back to work. I am especially worried about our young workers, people who have graduated high school, finding it very, very hard to get a job. People who graduated college, often in debt, finding it very, very hard to get a job. We need a massive jobs bill, and I think we can do that by rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure and by transforming our energy system away from fossil fuel to energy efficiency and sustainable energy. Now, in that regard, there is a modest bill. There is a modest two-year transportation bill that ironically was worked out between Barbara Boxer, one of the more progressive members of the Senate, and Jim Inhofe, the ranking member of the committee, one of the more right-wing members. But Inhofe understands the need for infrastructure. Now, that bill does not go anywhere near as far as we must go, but it is a start. And it would put a substantial number of people back to work, rebuilding roads, bridges, serious problem with bridges all over this country, paying attention to rail, and so forth and so on. Now, we will see if our right-wing Republican friends will allow us to pass something significant. What they did in the House is a total disaster, but we are working on at least a modest transportation bill to rebuild our infrastructure, to put people back to work. Another issue that I know the listeners are interested in is the issue of the payroll tax. Literally, I just came from voting on that a few minutes ago, and I don't even know the final result on that. We'll know it in a minute. I suspect it will pass. I voted no. And I voted no not because I don't understand that the middle class needs a tax break. We absolutely need a tax break to help the hard-pressed middle class so they can get that money, go out and spend it, and create some jobs. It's significant. But I thought it important to continue raising the issue of the danger of diverting, in total, hundreds of billions of dollars from the Social Security Trust Fund. So when you lower up the payroll tax from 6.2 to 4.2, all you are doing at the moment is diverting huge amounts of money into the Social Security Trust Fund. Now, what the president says is that not to worry because the general treasury is going to repay that money. And I hope he is right. Furthermore, what the White House is saying is this is the last time that they will do that. And I hope that they are right on that as well. But I worry you do that 2 years in a row, that the next time this issue comes up, you'll have a lot of folks, whether Republicans or Democrats, saying if you don't vote to continue this, you're talking about a quote-unquote tax increase for the middle class. And you keep diverting huge sums of money away from the Social Security Trust Fund, which is something that the right wing, in fact, likes because it just undermines the future of Social Security. So middle class needs a tax break. We certainly need to extend unemployment benefits to long-term unemployed. We need to deal with this so-called doctor's fix for doctors' reimbursement rates for Medicare. But I voted no because I think it's important that we have to keep raising the issue. Social Security is of enormous consequence. We've got to strengthen it, not weaken it. Social Security hasn't contributed a nickel to the deficit. Got us the $2.5 trillion in its trust fund can pay out benefits for the next 25 years. We've got to keep it strong. I continue to work on another issue that I know many of our listeners are interested in. We've gotten remarkable response on our website, sanders.senate.gov, when we ask people how they feel about the Postal Service. And we've got just very strong response from people who support the Postal Service, do not want to see it dismembered. As I think I've mentioned before, the Postmaster General had come up with a very draconian proposal of shutting down 3,700 rural post offices, cutting half of the processing plants in this country, slowing down mail delivery, ending Saturday mail, laying off a substantial number of postal workers over a period of time, over 200,000. Many of them are veterans. We have been working very, very hard on this issue, working both with the committee, and I have to say Majority Leader Reid has come into the picture here, is playing a good role in trying to protect the Postal Service, working with the Postmaster General, Donahoe, trying to get some movement there. And I think we may be making some progress here. The bottom line is we think for a bunch of reasons, not the least of which the Postal Service has been asked to come up with $5.5 billion for future retiree health benefits in a way that no other institution in this country has been forced to do. It is strong financially. They don't need to put more money into it. There are other ways that we can save money and keep the Postal Service strong. And that we're working hard on that issue. Last issue, there have been just some incredible attacks against women and the right of women to receive contraceptive service through their insurance programs. You're seeing a right-wing male chauvinism that really surprised me, that takes us back to where we were 30 or 40 years ago. And all of us have got to protect a woman's right, not only to choose, but to make sure that she gets the contraceptive that she needs.
Well said. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, our national town hall meeting. Bernie will be taking your calls right after this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting from Chicago today from WCPT. And it's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. Check out his website at sanders.senate.gov. And Daniel in Austin, Texas, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you, Tom. It's an honor to speak with you, Senator Sanders. I wanted to know if you would support or introduce legislation for a 1% tax on Wall Street derivatives. Currently, there's an estimated roughly $700 trillion in these toxic derivatives and about $3.7 quadrillion in annual turnover. And I think one of the ways we can battle against this austerity demagogy is to close the corporate loopholes, as you're fighting for, to repeal the Bush tax cuts for the wealthiest 1%. But I wonder if you could be a leader in the Senate on pushing a tax on these Wall Street derivatives, a Wall Street sales tax, because when I go to the grocery, I'm forced to pay 8% on groceries, but Wall Street is turning these things over, especially with high-frequency trading as well, and not paying a sales tax.
All right, Daniel raises a very important issue, and I absolutely agree with you, Daniel. We have supported it. We do support it. I think we have introduced legislation to that effect. Not a radical idea. It exists in other countries. It has existed in America. And the benefit, what I call a transaction fee, whatever the number may be, 1%, 0.5%, or whatever it is, A, it will raise a significant sum of revenue, and second of all, it will have a dampening impact on speculation, which is certainly something that we want to do. I believe Senator Harkin of Iowa is going to be introducing legislation to that effect, and I certainly will work with him. But when we talk about progressive ways to raise revenue, I think that is one of the most progressive ways, and yes, that is certainly something that we will move forward on, either working with other people or doing it ourselves.
Okay, we have a call from Lakewood, Louisiana. I'm sorry, I can't quite read your name. My call screen software is a little fuzzy here remotely. Your name is? Hello?
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
I'm actually in California.
Sorry. See you.
That's okay. Not a problem. Anyways, the middle-class tax cut bill had Keystone XL pipeline attached to it. And now this transportation bill that is supposed to be funded by offshore oil leases and opening wilderness to drilling and fracking, is that correct? And if so, how do we get rid of poison pills with these bills? Because our job's really worth it.
Okay. And your name was?
Brenda.
Well, what Brenda is, I mentioned earlier the need for a strong transportation bill to rebuild our crumbling infrastructure and to put people back to work. I think the bill that's going to pass that is being debated now and came out of committee in the Senate, while much too modest, not enough money going into it, is a reasonable bill that I can support. The House bill is very, very different, as Brenda indicates. In the way they raise revenue in bad ways, reactionary ways, and it includes the Keystone XL project. So the hope is that what we will end up with is the Senate bill, not the House bill. Let me say a word about Keystone XL. A lot of reasons to be opposed to that. I think a lot of the discussion about jobs has been over-exaggerated in terms of the number of jobs that we'll create. But here is the point. As a nation, we are going to have to make a decision. I was on the floor of the House with a number of senators just the other day talking about this issue. Is global warming real and a threat to our planet? The evidence is overwhelming that it is. Virtually the entire scientific community believes that is the case, and countries all over the world and their leading scientists agree as well. If we are serious about dealing and reversing global warming, which is already having enormous impact on our planet, which will only get worse, we are going to have to end the addiction to oil, especially oil that is particularly filthy, that will, in terms of Keystone, emit far more greenhouse gas emissions than normal oil. So the goal right now is to transform our energy system away from oil, away from coal, away from fossil fuel, to energy efficiency and to sustainable energy. That should be the future of America. If we do that, we can create a whole lot of jobs, we slow down pollution, and we begin the process of leading the world in reversing global warming. And that is, in my view, the direction we've got to go.
Okay. Jim in Kelso, Washington. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders. Jim.
Yeah, good morning, Senator. My name's Jim, and I'd like to know about Daryl Issa. I keep hearing he's a convicted felon and everything. How can he be a member of Congress and be a convicted felon? Is there no laws regarding that?
I am not aware that he is a convicted felon. I don't know that that is the case. What I do know, and I don't know him personally, and I don't know much about him other than what I read, I think he is simply I know that he's very, very wealthy. I think one of the wealthiest people in the Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And I do know that he is a right-wing extremist, and that whatever passes or comes out of his committee is usually anti-worker, anti-middle class, and protecting the wealthy and corporate interests. So we will deal with that as best we can.
Okay. Michael in Dublin, Virginia, you're on the air with Senator Sanders. We have a minute to the break.
Okay. Senator Sanders, first of all, I'd like to thank you. You're such a true patriot and should be more like you, and I appreciate everything that you're doing. I'd like to ask you this question. Can we get other senators like yourself on board and convince them to stop accepting corporate lobbyist money to sell out our Constitution, hijack our democracy, and bring America down? And I think this is their plan. Can we stop it, sir?
Michael, you have asked the $64 question. That is a question of huge, huge consequence. What you have right now in Congress, in the House and the Senate, are institutions that are very, very significantly dominated by wealthy and powerful corporate interests. Tom, we'll continue this discussion after the break.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. It's a big one. And Bernie has I don't want to trump your answer, but I do want to plug it here going into the break, a constitutional amendment to address this issue over at sanders.senate.gov. He'll tell you all the details about it when we come back in just a moment. Tom Hartman here with you. Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It's our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie, and check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov. Welcome back to our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls at 866-987-THOM on pretty much any of the topics of the day. Bernie, our last caller set up the question, why is it that our politicians seem to be in the bag for big corporations and billionaires?
Okay, well,
it's all yours.
Michael, who called, raised the most profound and important political question of the moment, and that is the degree to which the political process in America today is controlled by big money interests and large corporations. And as bad as the situation has been for a very long time, it has been made significantly worse, Michael, by the disastrous 5-4 Citizens United decision, Supreme Court decision, that said corporations are people, they have First Amendment rights, and they can spend as much money as they want on political advertising. And we're seeing the impact of that right now, not only in the Republican presidential primaries, but in Senate races around the country. In Ohio, for example, my understanding is these super PACs are already putting some $3 million in television ads to try to defeat Senator Sherrod Brown, and we're seeing that all over the country, and we are going to see more of it. Bottom line here is that we are moving to a situation where a handful of billionaires are now able to spend huge amounts of money through folks like Karl Rove or the Koch brothers to influence the political process. This is not what American democracy is supposed to be about. I've got a constitutional amendment in now to overturn Citizens United. There are other good constitutional amendments that have been offered. There's legislation that we hope to bring to the floor of the Senate to diminish the impact of Citizens United. But if anyone is concerned about the economy, the rights of working families in the middle class, health care, the environment, whatever, you have got to be concerned about this issue. Because right now we're moving rapidly to an oligarchic form of politics where a handful of billionaires are going to control the political process unless we turn that around.
And sanders.senate.gov is where you can sign Bernie's proposed constitutional amendment to get this thing fixed. Brett over in Sarasota, Florida, listening to WSLR. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thanks, Tom. Yeah, we're proud to stream you live at WSLR.org. Senator Sanders, thank you for all the work that you do, especially as a postal employee, for trying to save my job. My question is related to I have a withholding problem with my income taxes, where I pay about 18% every year. So at the end of the year when I file, they want an additional 10 to 15% for me to pay. Given that the Supreme Court has said that money is free speech and that I'm radically dissatisfied with a lot of the things the government is doing, from illegal foreign wars to bank deregulation, it goes on, am I exercising my right to free speech and protest the government by not paying that additional 12% and filing at the end of the year? And I'll listen to your comments out there.
Well, I guess, Brett, you are exercising your right, but you're breaking the law, and you're going to get into some trouble if you do that. What I think you're raising is a question, really, of national priorities. I don't think everybody can pick and choose about where we pay taxes and where we want it to go or where we don't want it to go. I think you have a pretty chaotic situation. But this is what we can do and must do. And that is to say, if we're going to pay taxes, where is that money going? Where should it be going? That speaks to national priorities and what our progressive vision is for America. Should we be spending money on a weapon system that is no longer necessary, or should we be making sure that our children get child care and the best education that they can get? So I think the issue comes down to, as taxpayers, we have got to engage in a real fight on national priorities and ask the questions why we are the only country in the industrialized world that doesn't guarantee health care to all people through a national health care program, why we have so many young people who can't afford to go to college, why our child care system is a disaster, why our infrastructure is in many ways collapsing, and et cetera, et cetera. So, Brett, I think the fight is to change national priorities to have a fair tax system. And by the way, it looks to me like you're paying a higher percentage of your income in federal taxes than Mitt Romney is, who I suspect has a bit more money than you do.
Well said. Brenda, in Green Bay, Wisconsin, Washington, on Free Speech TV. Brenda, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yes, I wanted to ask Bernie Sanders, what does he think of hydrogen fuel cell automobile engines versus the fossil fuel?
Well, Brenda, what I think is that in 20 or 30 years, there is a very good chance that we are not going to be driving cars which have an internal combustion engine and that are using gas. I think that there is, as you know, a significant movement now toward hybrid cars. There is a growing movement toward pure electric cars. We're in an early stage. I think there's going to be a lot more development in that area. But I suspect that what you're going to see in years to come is the electrification of our transportation system away from fossil fuels. Short term, we hope that by the year 2025, you're going to have CAFE standards, i.e., the mileage per gallon that automobile makers must achieve in their cars to be over 50 miles per gallon. And when we do that, we're going to save a very significant significant reduction in the amount of oil that we use to move our transportation system.
Jim in Los Angeles, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Tom, Senator Sanders, it's a privilege as always. I just wanted to ask you, Senator Sanders, do you ever think we will get one bill, one issue through the Congress? This thing of we get good progressive legislation like stimulus and this sort of thing, and then suddenly we've got the pipeline tacked onto it in order for any Republicans to support it. To my way of thinking, that's totally destructive, and I'd like to see if you could do something about it.
Well, Jim, good question, but here's the answer. What people have to understand is that right now the U.S. House of Representatives is controlled by the most right-wing leadership. It is the most right-wing Congress in the modern history of America. And on every single piece of legislation that they move, their goal is to protect the interests of corporate America and the wealthiest people in this country, and to undo,
in virtually every instance. Those pieces of legislation that have been passed since the mid-1930s that protect the elderly, i.e. Social Security and Medicare, protect the sick, Medicaid, and other public health programs, to cut back on programs for low-income people. We have the highest rate, more people living in poverty today than at any time in our history. We are in a terrible recession, people falling out of the middle class, and they want to cut back on programs for low-income people. They are vehemently anti-union. So what I would say to you, Jim, you have to be conscious that every piece of legislation that they will pass will be anti-middle class, anti-worker, increasingly anti-woman, anti-environment. And what we have got to do in the Senate is fight back and say thanks, but no thanks. And the American people have got to join in and say no. We are not going to retreat to where we were in the 1920s when a handful of very wealthy people controlled the economics and politics of this country.
Rob in Zelianapolis, I'm sure I'm mispronouncing it, Pennsylvania. Rob?
Yes, I'd like to ask Mr. Sanders if he would put a bill in front of the House or Senate about a two-tier wage system. When you get out of school, you have to make a living wage instead of a minimum wage that they're paying now.
Well, Rob, I won't do that because I think the issue is more complicated than that. But Rob raises a very, very important issue, Tom. When we talk about the economy, often what we talk about is the serious problem of unemployment. That is a huge problem. It is especially, as we've heard this afternoon, an especially acute problem for younger workers. But it is not just unemployment. You got a lot of people who are holding jobs today, including young people, where these wages are not high enough to allow them, if they're young, to pay back their college loans, to get decent housing. You got more and more young people living with their parents, can't go out on their own. And in terms of the middle class, what we're seeing, a very dangerous phenomenon, in that we're seeing the beginning of more manufacturing jobs, but those new manufacturing jobs are paying significantly less than the old manufacturing jobs, sometimes to the tune of 10, 20, 30% less. So the fight right now is not only to have a full employment economy, to not accept these arguments about austerity, that we got to lower wages, that we got to increase unemployment, we got to reject that completely. The fight has got to be for a full employment economy, and we know how to do that, while at the same time to make sure that the jobs that are being created, not just for young people, but for all workers. You got a lot of older workers who have lost their jobs, their new jobs pay substantially less. Decent, livable wages, full employment should be our goal.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour here on the Tom Hartman Program, our national town hall meeting. Bernie taking your calls. We'll be back with more of your calls for Bernie right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Check out Bernie's website. You can subscribe to his newsletter as well, the Bernie Buzz, over at Sanders.Senate.gov. Highly recommended newsletter. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting from Chicago today. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line in Washington, D.C. Omar, Bloomington, Indiana, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, how you doing? I think you're great, and wish all the reps were like you. Would you consider, or would the Washington establishment consider, a bill to just do away with all lobbies and get the corruption out of Washington?
Probably not. I mean, I don't think that's something that would pass because the lobbyists are too powerful unto themselves. The issue is, I think we have a twofold issue, Omar, and that is the impact of corporate lobbyists on the political process and campaign fundraising as well. You add those two factors together that increasingly, especially as a result of Citizens United, I just talked to a friend of mine, running for re-election, as I am, by the way, and I said, well, what'd you do? You're working on this? He said, no, I have to be in a room raising money all of the time because Citizens United is going to come after me, and I've got to raise money. What a terrible thing it is. What an insult to the democratic process. You got smart people who want to deal with the pressing problems facing our country, unemployment, infrastructure, health care, et cetera. We can't do that. They can't do that. They're too busy raising money because Karl Rove and the Koch brothers are going to pour millions of dollars into their state. The issue of lobbyists is, I think, what we at least can do for the moment is make sure that there is a firm wall between those people who have served government in whatever capacity so that when they leave, they don't go running to some large corporation and use the contacts as they previously had in order to push legislation that benefits corporate America. But passing legislation, stopping that, I don't see that in the cards of this Congress.
Carlana, in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, back to the postal issue. A very good reason to keep the postal workers in place is that we could have a serious national crisis, such as if we lost our electricity, if we had a pandemic where a lot of people were dying, if there was, somebody had hacked into something and it wasn't working. Anyway, the point being that the postal workers are in place, and they're able, they could be considered first responders or second responders to these sort of things and could keep things working and could be a source of communication if we lost our phone service and our electricity.
I think that that is a very good point. Today and every day, letter carriers will be delivering mail to about 150 million doors all over this country. And to pick up on the caller's point, right now, as I understand it, by law, if God forbid there is ever a chemical attack against this country, anthrax or whatever it may be, postal workers now have the responsibility of delivering the antidotes to doors all over this country. So in the event of an emergency, if you need a drug to deal with nerve gas or whatever it may be, right now the Postal Service has the responsibility of getting that drug out throughout America. So I think the caller's point is a very good one. The issue that we're trying to deal with right now as we look at how we can raise more revenue for the Postal Service is what other services can the Postal Service provide, whether it's post offices or letter carriers. And in Europe and other parts of the world, they have been much more imaginative in moving the Postal Service away from strictly just letters and packages into other areas. But the caller makes a very, very important point.
Christina in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening on AM 1350. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Thank you. Senator Sanders, I appreciate what you do for all Americans, not just your state. With respect to Representative Issa's recent hearing, supposedly on religious freedom, but I believe actually an attack on contraception and women, were there any Democrats involved in this hearing? And if so, why didn't they show their disdain by walking out? In this day and age, not allowing women to testify in a congressional hearing is outrageous. Thank you.
To the best of my knowledge, there were no women on the morning panel of witnesses. And, in fact, the Democratic women members of the House committee did walk out of that hearing. So to answer your question, I guess that's exactly what the women did in protest. I know that today on the Senate floor, Senator Patty Murray and Senator Gillibrand of New York got to the floor and made the point. What an outrage. What an outrage that we are in the year 2012. You have a panel of all men talking about contraception for women. I mean, that is beyond comprehension. So to answer the caller's question, my understanding is that the women members of the committee did, in fact, walk out.
John in Topanga, California. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Tom and Bernie. I've got a question with regard to the Social Security payroll tax reduction. There's a really insidious part of that that nobody is talking about, which is that everyone's future Social Security benefits are based on how much they and their various employers over their working lifetime pay into the system. And if that amount is cut very significantly, as it is presently about to be done, then everybody's future benefits are going to go way down. And if anybody thinks that once those cuts are made, they'll ever be rescinded, they're nuts, because you can see what happens every time it comes up for expiration. Everybody moans and groans and says, oh, you're going to raise everybody's taxes.
Okay, John, we have just 1 minute here to the end of the show, or the end of this hour, so let me let Bernie respond to your comment.
I agree with you, but it's just not true that nobody is talking about this issue. Last year, I was on the floor for 8.5 hours talking about this issue. An hour ago, I just voted against the extension of the payroll tax holiday precisely for that reason, and a number of other people did as well. So the point is that what John is saying, which is absolutely correct, is if you lower the payroll tax from 6.2 to 4.2 for a year, you're diverting about $100 billion out of the Social Security Trust Fund. President says not to worry because that money will be repaid by the federal government. I agree with John. I am nervous about that, and that is why I voted against the payroll tax holiday.
Senator Bernie Sanders, check out his website at sanders.senate.gov. Bernie, thanks so much for being with us today.
Good to be with you, Tom.
It's always an honor to host you on this program every Friday. Our Brunch with Bernie Hour, Senator Bernie Sanders, sanders.senate.gov. Sign up for the Bernie Buzz and get Bernie's and sign on to his constitutional amendment.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So it's Friday. Anything goes Friday. The House and Senate, by the way, did vote to pass the extension of the payroll tax cut. And there's some strange pieces to this legislation and odd ways that things were funded. And there's a lot to dislike in it. On the other hand, the rationale of the administration, in particular, that it's taking a bite out of it's not actually taking a bite out of Social Security because it's being repaid by the general fund, but it's setting the precedent for cutting the income flow to Social Security, and the Republicans are going to do everything they can with that as time goes forward to try to break Social Security so they can, like with the post office right now, where they put this poison pill in 2006 that said that over the next 10 years, just in a 10-year period, 2006 to 2016, that the post office had to fund the health retirement payment benefit payments of its workers for the next 75 years. And so all of a sudden you had a post office that went from being showing a profit, actually, to having a post office that's like showing a deficit. And one caller asked the question in the last hour. I thought it was absolutely brilliant. We don't ask the Army to show a profit, do we? I mean, isn't there something to be said for a federal agency that's performing an important service to continue to do that, whether it shows a profit or a loss? If you look at the history of the post office over the last 200 years, 230 plus years that it's been in existence, I mean, in fact, it's one of the few agencies that's listed in the Constitution. Congress has the right to build roads. Why? For postal service. So anyhow, if it's part of our commons, if it's part of something that's such vital infrastructure, then why not go back to looking at it the way we did before the 1970s? Where, you know, some years the post office makes money, some years it doesn't. It's no big deal. It's an important service. But in the 70s, they changed it to say, you know, to spin it off as kind of a private, well, it's not a private corporation. It's a congressionally authorized corporation that's a government-run individual entity, for lack of a better phrase. I'm not sure that there's an exact, there probably is some obscure legal phrase that exactly defines it or explains it, but in any case, so that's what's going on, and the law just did get passed. Tara in Palm Beach. Hey, Tara, what's on your mind today?
Oh, my God. I've been waiting so long. It's good to talk to you.
Well, thanks for calling.
I did want to talk to Bernie about the Everglades where they have the leases for the oil. Mm. I know you were talking about leasing land for the oil, and I live in Florida, and I was wondering how close to the Everglades, really, and to the Gulf beaches would they be?
Oh, are you in Palm Beach, Florida? as opposed to California?
Yeah,
oh, okay. I thought you were California.
Yeah, Palm Beach, Florida.
Yeah. I don't know exactly where, and that's something that you could probably track down by calling the local county. The Everglades are much more than just one county.
I know that they're trying to stick that stuff in a bill, and it's almost like you're talking about the XL pipeline,
right.
And they want to stick that sneaky into another bill, you know?
At the federal level.
I have another question about the postal workers.
Hmm.
You know, we always need postal workers. We're always going to need the post office. And being in it, something that is actually needed, don't tax dollars fund the post office, or no?
No. Since the 1970s, the post office has been funded entirely through the sale of postage. And before Congress said that they have to take 75 years worth of retirement health expenses and front load them and pay for them in a 10-year period, so it's $5.5 or $5.6 billion a year that they've got to come up with to put into this giant trust fund for future postal employees' retirement, future postal employees who have not yet been born. And this was just put in there by the Republicans in 2006 to break the Postal Service, to throw them into a financial crisis, which it has done.
I think it's crazy.
It absolutely is. Tara, thank you for your call. You're spot on. And Bernie's trying to do something about it. But Senator Sanders has introduced legislation along with a number of other senators to try and fix this. And good on them. And hopefully it'll move forward. Sam in Point Pleasant, West Virginia. How you doing, my friend?
I'm doing pretty good, brother. I was wanting to talk to the Honorable Senator Bernie Sanders about a couple bills.
Well, he's not here, so you got to talk to me. What's up?
Well, I think it'd be reasonable to have a Gifford gun bill, and I'm an NRA member,
mm-hmm.
and I think they should limit the clips on these pistols because it's unsportsmanship, and it's supposed to be about sportsmanship. On these pistols, it's not how many bullets you fire, it's how many few bullets. The target, you don't want to have a target and have to shoot 30 bullets out of a pistol.
Yep.
It should be a law passed, 15 at the max, or whatever fits in the handle.
Yeah, which is typically 8 or 9, depending on the type of weapon it is.
Yeah, but if they go, you go up to 14 or 15... that give them lenience, which they don't deserve.
Yeah.
But 31 or 32, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, a 30. Yeah, no, I'm with you, Sam, and thank you for calling and making the point. A 30 shot clip is nuts, and that's the kind of thing that is typically used for these, school shootings or going after congresswomen and things like that. And I can understand an exemption that says on a shooting range you can put a 30 shot clip in there. For people who just, want to shoot for recreation on a shooting range, but not out in the wild, right? Not out in the wild. Cliff in Santa Clarita. Hey, Cliff, what's up?
Hello, Tom. Quickly, I would like to thank you for every time you have Paul Guntner or Kevin Camps on to inform us about Fukushima. Because it's really one of the more important unreported stories we got going.
Oh yeah,
and
we need to get these guys back on. In fact, because the reactor number two just heated up again last week, and they're freaking out about it.
Yeah, I mean this is current stuff, and we're not hearing anything about it here in the States. Another really important unreported issue is the GMO story around the globe.
Mm-hmm.
I called last week. I got through to Senator Sanders about this, and. I was a bad caller last week. I wasn't really prepared with a question, which is, what the Bernie segment's about, Q&A.
Sure.
I just started ranting, and I didn't really get my full message out. But his response was great for local levels, talking about supporting local farmers and eating organic, which is what I do. But there's billions of people that aren't in that category in this planet. They can't afford it or they don't have access.
Yeah.
But before, let me give out a website, Tom, before I continue, because for anybody who can hear my voice and wants to know about the dangers of GMO, go to responsibletechnology.org. It's okay. Got all the information you could.
GMO mean genetically modified organisms, and this is genetically modified food. And you've got now farmers committing suicide in India because of this. You've got all these people displaced off the land all over Central and South America. In Asia, they're having problems with it. There are countries now starting to say, we don't want genetically modified organisms anymore. We're going to regulate them. We're going to knock them out. We're going to prevent them.
But
we're not among them.
No, we're not. And,
in fact, you're not even entitled to know if there's GMO food in your food.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm getting at. In November, I think there's a ballot initiative in California where I live that's going to, we can vote on whether they have to require labeling for these foods in our markets. Because right now, as a consumer, you don't know. You can't distinguish between one or the other. It's like in Europe, I think GMOs are illegal. But,
many of the countries,
It's like the Clorexic thing. Clorexic was illegal in England, but we dumped it here in the Gulf of Mexico.
Yep.
GMOs are illegal there, and they're flooded our markets. I mean, this biotechnology agenda is very scary.
Well, it's all about making money, even if you're doing it off life forms. Cliff, thanks for the call, and thanks for the heads up on the website and all the information. We'll be back with more of your thoughts and calls, and mine, on Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Broadcasting from Chicago, where tomorrow I'll be keynoting the Democratic Party of DuPage County's big President's Day gig.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows, anything goes.
Anything goes Friday. Reginald in Houston, Texas. You're on the air, sir. What's up?
Good morning. Hey, Tom?
Yeah.
Hey, how you doing? Yeah, I wanted to talk on the aggression and escalation of intervening in the possible war between Iran and Syria. You know, we left Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya in a mess. And President Obama had a prayer breakfast here a while back in last week or so, and he said we're a religious nation, and we're supposed to be blessed out of peacekeepers. And with diplomacy, why aren't we bringing people together at the table of the brotherhood? This brother, Obama has a Nobel Peace Prize. He got that book out, Audacity of Hope. But it seems like we're divide and conquer. And if Israel goes in a war, aggression, would we follow that? And Tom, what would be your prayer, if you were at the prayer breakfast that you could give to Obama for this nation from your, thoughtful insight?
Well, my prayer is that people wake up to the fact that war is institutionalized insanity. It's institutionalized mass murder. There is virtually no war that's not a crime on its face. With regard to Israel and Iran, because you brought up two different issues, Israel, Iran, and Syria. With regard to the possibility of Israel striking Iran, I hope they don't. And I don't personally think that Iran getting a nuclear weapon is that big a deal. I just don't. Pakistan has a nuclear weapon. India has a nuclear weapon. Israel has a nuclear weapon. North Korea has a nuclear weapon. We need international nuclear nonproliferation. That would be a good thing. And anything that we can do to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon is, in the abstract, and specifically even, a good thing. But going to war over it, I mean, the whole reason why they're doing this is because George W. Bush said there's three countries that are the axis of evil, and he was going to take them out: Iraq, Iran, and North Korea. And then he took out Iraq, and that caused the people in North Korea and Iran to sit up and take notice and say, "Damn, we better do something." And immediately, Kim Jong Il is blowing off nukes in Iran, in North Korea, and all of a sudden, George W. Bush shut up about taking out North Korea, and Iran, is rushing to try and get there. They're looking at having nuclear weapons as a defensive option, not, frankly, in my opinion, as an offensive option. The area is too small. The territory is too small. I mean, if they were to use a nuclear weapon against anybody, against Israel, anybody in the region, we've got 41 military bases ringing Iran right now. The response would be overwhelming and devastating. So there's no possibility, frankly, very little possibility that they're having a nuclear weapon would be a risk, number one. And if you want to talk about loose nukes and the risk of nuclear proliferation, then we should be working with the former Soviet states and with Russia to nail down a lot of this nuclear material that's gone wild, and that's a real issue. With regard to Syria, we're now seeing in Libya what happens when, you know, you just go in and you shake things up and kick them around, kick the hornet's nest, and then walk away. The secret police in Libya right now, the new administration, are torturing people, and there's nothing we can do about it. And it's like you have to have, if you're going to have a change of government, it can't be because some other country came along and bombed you. It's got to be indigenous. It's got to be from the ground up. It's got to be like the American Revolution. Yes, the French gave us some money, you know, to fight the American Revolution, but, you know, we basically fought the British, and it was us, and I just think we would make it would be a terrible mistake for us to, as much as I hate what's going on in Syria and I'm horrified by Bashir and his government, the world is horrified and the people of Syria are horrified, and the Syrians have to resolve this. If we resolve it for them, as we've seen in Afghanistan, where the Taliban, mark my words, in 10 years will be back with a vengeance, and as we've seen in Iraq, where right now you've seen just utter destruction. I mean, you know, 5 million refugees out of Iraq, somewhere between 100,000 and 1 million people dead. That's a horrible, horrible price to pay for. There was not even a war going on. You had Saddam Hussein was a tyrant, but he was like, you know, by the standards of the world, you know, compared to Burma, for example, he was a moderate tyrant. So it's like, you know,
Iraq was called the Cadillac of the Middle East when he was there. We left that country worse than what it is.
Iraq was a very, very sophisticated and advanced and secular country before George Bush the Elder started bombing them, you know, went after them. And Saddam Hussein, you know, went to April Gillespie. He went to the Bush administration, the first Bush administration, and said, you know, the Kuwaitis are drilling slant wells under our border and they're sucking our oil out and we want to stop it. And besides that, Kuwait used to be a part of the territory of Iraq, our 38th state or something like that. And so we're going to take it back. Is that all right with you? And April Gillespie said, we're not going to stop you. And so he invades Kuwait, and all of a sudden George Herbert Walker Bush has an opportunity for a war that'll make, you know, that'll help him get reelected. And it's just, I mean, you look at, and by the way, Saddam Hussein wouldn't be the dictator there if the CIA hadn't gone in the early 50s and helped him overthrow a democratically elected government. There was also in the 1950s a democratically elected government in Iran, and the CIA helped overthrow that with the Shah. It's like we had this aversion to democratically elected governments in the Middle East because they were nationalizing their oil, and they were saying to the American oil companies who had cut deals or wanted to cut deals with dictators in the area, this oil is ours, and we're going to charge whatever price we want, and we're going to use that money for the people. And we just, you know, you can't have that. And it's not unlike, you know, our horror with Venezuela. Oh, my God, Chavez is taking oil money. He's nationalized the oil, and he's taking oil money, and he's using that oil money to pay for health care for people in Venezuela and to pay for low-income housing in Venezuela and to pay, you know, we can't have this. That's horrible. And it's like our foreign policy has been insane for the last half century, and we need to wake up. I mean, thanks a lot, Reginald. I mean, this rant that I just went off on, by the way, used to be the official position of the Republican Party, particularly after World War I, after Democratic President Woodrow Wilson basically talked us into participating in World War I. And a lot of people were pretty horrified by that. And so the Republican Party, right up to World War II, was saying, no, let's not intervene anywhere in the world. Now, I think we did the right thing in Germany, but
you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Going into Syria would be a disaster right now, particularly given how complex that situation is, the Alawites and everybody else that's Shia. We'll be back. Fair and only slightly unbalanced. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. Oh, my, oh, my, oh, my. Congress deals a major blow to the wind power industry. This is pretty grim news. It's particularly going to hit Chicago bad, where 13,000 megawatts, a megawatt is a million watts, 13,000 million watts of wind projects, enough to power 3.3 million homes, are in the process of being built. And Congress has said, nah, we're not going to fund this stuff anymore. It's just, It's really tragic what happens when Republicans get control of Congress. Dan in Washington, D.C. Hey, Dan, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I want to disagree with something you've said concerning the reduction in the payroll tax. And it sounds like a small technical point, but I think it has a tremendous future impact on public support for Social Security. The Republican strategy has been to equate the Social Security fund with the general fund. And you have in the past been very elegant in saying the fact that the Social Security fund has invested in Treasury bills does not equate it. That's a dedicated fund, and they've made that investment. But now,
by and large, yeah.
And the statement I'm disagreeing with is that you've said in the last couple of days that the Social Security fund will be repaid from the general fund. I believe that's not correct. I believe they're saying that they will pay for the cuts in the reduction in the Social Security tax by FCC licensing and having new federal employees put more into their
right. They're going to do a whole bunch of different things that are going to raise revenue in the general fund, and then they'll use that general fund money to hand off to the Social Security Administration and say, "Here, buy some more Treasury bills."
But I don't believe they are taking that second step. There's just going to be less money in the Social Security Trust Fund. And so that pay for has the effect of equating the general fund with the Social Security Trust Fund. And by not taking
that. Dan, are you sure that you're right?
I am. From everything I've read, I have a newspaper article from the Sacramento newspaper in front of me, and they're using the term "it will be paid for," and it
right.
is the reason that Americans support Social Security so much, so universally, is we all know that such a big chunk has been taken out of our paycheck,
right.
and it is such a dangerous, slippery slope. Obama has said anybody who wants to go back to the Social Security taxes that Reagan approved wants to raise taxes on the middle class, and
right.
so it's almost like free money, and I understand all the arguments you've made in terms of how difficult it is for Obama to otherwise keep the economy going.
Well, hang on just a second, Dan. Right now, you remember when Al Gore was running for president and he was running around the country talking about Social Security lockboxes?
Exactly, yes.
What he was saying is that right now, all the Social Security money, even though it ends up in the Social Security Administration, it is arguably going through the general fund to get there. Basically, everything is going through Congress and through the the total funding of the government. The Social Security Administration is not the tax collector; it's the Internal Revenue Service. The Internal Revenue Service puts money into the general fund. Then Congress takes money out, or then by law that money is taken out of the general fund and put in the Social Security Trust Fund. And what Al Gore was trying to do was separate those two, put a genuine firewall in there,
right? And, a bright line between the general
right,
fund
but,
and the
but
Social
it has
Security
never been,
Trust
but it has
fund.
It has never been there. There has always been a certain level of commingling of funds, or of at least pass through of funds. So I think we may be arguing about how many angels can fit on the head of a pin here.
I believe that it's a substantial difference because using your logic, when the Social Security Trust Fund money got put into the general fund, there were treasury bills issued to the Social Security Trust Fund.
Right.
If that step is not taken, if I am correct about that, that is an important decision.
You're absolutely right. If you're correct about it, but on the other hand, the Social Security actuaries, the Social Security Administration itself has said that this action that was taken last year and is being taken again this year, so this is not something that's brand new that we don't know what the consequences are going to be, that it is not going to will not move closer into us right now, the date at which Social Security is going to need a little extra money, which right now I think is 2027 or 2029. And if it's not changing that date, then it has to mean that money is somehow, whether it's coming out of federal pensions or whatever, that money is somehow ending up in the Social Security Trust Fund, or the Social Security Trust Fund has the right to draw against the general fund to that tune. Maybe they don't do it this week or next, but they have the right to. But presumably they do, because they're making interest on those government bonds as well.
they can come to that conclusion if in fact they don't separately issue T-bills to the Social Security Trust Fund.
Right.
They can come to the conclusion that the integrity remains by equating the Social Security Trust Fund with the general fund. And that's the step that the Republicans win by if that step is taken.
Yeah.
So every effort I've, you know, there's terrible, there's a, your show is about the only place I've called in previously. Bernie has raised the issue, but this concern about the slippery slope is there, and to the best of my ability, maybe you can use your resources, which are much greater, and if you find out that, in fact, the Social Security Trust Fund is not being issued T-notes or any other specific dedicated funds to repay the reduction of income to the Social Security Trust Fund, that I would think we're agreeing that results in equating the general fund with the Social Security Trust Fund,
and that's a serious problem. Dan, let me do some poking around and find out.
I appreciate everything you do. Thanks.
Thank
so
you
much.
Very much. Thanks for listening to us, Max in New Haven, Connecticut. Hey, Max, what's up?
Hey, I just wondering if you ever heard anything more about Clarence Thomas' 5 years of non-disclosures of his wife's income to the.
Well, he's confessed to it, as it were, that he did not disclose his wife's quite substantial income. I mean, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars from the Heritage Foundation funded by the Koch brothers and others. He, you know, when it was pointed out, he did disclose it. And there have been people who have said he should be impeached for that. But Congress has no stomach for that, apparently. And there are people who have said he should resign for that. And he's told them to go take a leap. And there are people who have said that he should recuse himself from anything, any case that comes before the court in which the Koch brothers or Citizens United or any of these right-wing, you know, groups that his wife has an affiliation with or has taken money from have had any role to play in to avoid even the appearance of impropriety, as is required of every other federal judge, but not required of the Supreme Court. It's simply assumed that the Supreme Court will have that level of integrity, and he has said unambiguously that he's not going to do that. In other words, he does not have that level of integrity. So we're stuck. You know, as long as he wants to sit there, unless Congress is going to remove him, unless they were going to impeach him, there's nothing that can be done about it. So, making sense.
Isn't it a federal crime to lie under oath on your disclosure forms?
I don't know. I don't know. For a Supreme Court justice, I don't know if those disclosure forms are, you know, if failing to disclose correctly on those is actually a crime, or if it is a matter of policy. And if it is a crime, it would have to be prosecuted. If it would be a federal crime, it would have to be prosecuted by the Justice Department. And now we're back to, you know, is the Justice Department, is the executive branch going to go after the judiciary branch? And that would cause a constitutional crisis. That would be a much bigger deal than having a corrupt member of the Supreme Court, frankly. And not that I'm opposed to it, but it's, you know, the Obama administration or the Bush administration, you know, or any administration would have to be looking at that going, you know, is this a fight we want to have? Because whenever one branch of Congress goes after another, or one branch of government, of the three branches of government, goes after another, it's a huge deal. It's like the impeachment of Bill Clinton when the legislative branch went after the executive branch. The consequences were enormous, and this would be as well. So, Max, I just don't see anything happening other than that we all acknowledge that we have one of the most corrupt members of the Supreme Court. And it's not just Thomas, by the way. Scalia as well, and Alito now as well, taking money from these people. And apparently Thomas. I don't know. I haven't seen the actual definite on Thomas. But certainly those guys, those three guys. And, you know, we've got a corrupted Supreme Court, and we need to do something about it. But, you know, it's going to take some time. Kwame in West Bloomfield, Michigan. Hey, Kwame, we got a minute to the break. What's up?
All right. I was just wondering, Tom, have you heard of any buzz about a lot of U.S. citizens migrating to Canada? Guys, I know my wife and myself are leaving because of everything you guys have been talking about.
Yeah.
It seems like the fight is not worth fighting anymore.
Yeah, you know, I've heard of people trying to leave to go to Canada, but Canada has also tightened up their immigration laws substantially, and they're basically only going to let you in if you've got a large chunk of cash to bring with you.
Yeah, we have enough. You need about $50,000 roughly in reserve.
Oh, I thought it was like 10 times that you needed. I mean, a friend of mine is a physician. He moved to Canada, got a job as a psychiatrist, and was also teaching at a university. And, you know, when he hit his 50s, they bounced him out of the country. So,
wow.
So yeah.
I think you have to have enough to live for at least 3 years.
Okay. Well, Kwame, I don't know if there is a large movement of like that. Frankly, it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, Canada, consider this. The United States, we spend about 22% of our GDP for government programs. And you got right-wingers all hysterical about that. Canada spends almost 50% of their GDP for government programs because they cover health care and they heavily subsidize higher education. And it produces a better quality of life. Kwame, thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I don't know why more people don't, you know, like, visit Canada, visit Europe, visit some of these countries where they're doing these things and come back and say, nah, hey, you know, we could do this.
On the road again. Just can't wait to get on the road again. The life I love is making music with my friends. I can't wait to get on the road again.
Well, I am on the road here in Chicago, where I'll be speaking tomorrow at the Democratic Party of DuPage County's President's Day gig. And this should be great fun. And I'm the keynote speaker for their President's Day Gala 2012. And Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service is on the line. She is also on the road. She's in Montana, if I have that right. Do I have that right, Ellen?
Yes, in fact, Barbara Koppel, who is the filmmaker who did the film where you appear a couple times, asked me whether you had seen the film yet. I said no. I said I was going to show it to you and Louise shortly.
Great. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, it's at Big Sky Film Festival, and the film is called A Force of Nature. In any case, speaking of forces, the AFL-CIO this morning sent a letter asking that people not support the payroll tax cut, 3630 is the actual bill number, because of the lessening number of unemployment weeks and the offset they felt will have a problem with the stimulating the economic growth and the lack of an increased tax on rich people. However, it did pass a 293 to 132 with 91 Republicans and 41 Democrats voting against. Then it went to the Senate, where it passed 60 to 36.
Oh, that's interesting.
And Nancy Pelosi actually did give a floor speech on it today, and she basically said that it was not perfect. She did, though, declare it a victory for the middle class. She said the Republicans wanted a surcharge for the unemployment. That has never historically been the case that they've ever put one. She said that, unfortunately, it took money out of the Affordable Care Act, and she said none of this needed to be offset, and she agreed with the AFL-CIO saying that they are going to, this is going to diminish the stimulus effect. Speaking of the stimulus effect,
mm-hmm.
Your friend and mine, Mr. Priebus from the Republican National Committee.
For the record, I've never met the man.
Well, he went on the president today, and he basically said, look, this stimulus is ridiculous. It hasn't worked. Now, when you actually put that against what has really happened, in fact, that there are much better numbers looking today on several fronts, including things like manufacturing. I don't know where he's getting his numbers, but you know, he said, well, the president promised that the unemployment rate would be less than 8%. Well, in fact, it's close to less than 8%.
Well, not only that, the president never promised that. One of his spokespeople said that was the goal. And he has said that it would be nice to reach that, but he never promised that. It's
right.
You know, this is a Republican talking point that has been repeated so often that people take it as
law.
People take it as true, and it's not true.
Okay, so on the president today is on his way to Boeing at 2:30 Eastern time. He's going to be making a speech at Boeing. He's talking about manufacturing that is 60% of U.S. exports. That has increased its exports 45%. that the XM Bank is what he is really working on. Actually, my friend has run the XM Bank. He's doing an amazing job for Hochberg, and he said that they're trying to increase loans, credit guarantees, they are also going to work on expanding loans to small groups. They're calling it Global Credit Express. Now, this is very interesting because, Tom, I haven't talked to you about this yet, but I'm starting a silkscreen business in South Sudan, and that's exactly where we're going to go. We're going to go to the XM Bank for financing, and now that there's going to be this Business USA one-stop, it's going to be a lot easier for us to pull this off.
Very interesting.
And this is all because of the president.
Yeah, that's great.
So that is happening today. Now, as you know, there was a big thing with Boeing because of them trying to move their plant to South Carolina. Well, apparently a deal was struck where 737s and some other planes will be made in Washington, and the Dreamliner will be made in South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much, and what the president is also going to say is that there are suppliers in all 50 states on that front. Also today, Senators Boxer and Gildibrand New York and California got on the floor today and continued the discussion that Nancy Pelosi asked yesterday. Where are the women? As you know, the Republicans had this five-panel group yesterday with no women on it about the contraception issue.
Right. And then Daryl Issa came along and said, well, there were no women on the panel because it wasn't about contraception. It was about religious freedom, which begs the question, women don't care about religious freedom? There are no religious women in the United States? or secular women, for that matter? Women don't have an opinion on this? Or is it that, in Daryl Issa's mind, women simply don't have a right to an opinion on religious freedom, if that's really what the hearing was about?
Right. Well, of course, that wasn't what the hearing was about.
I mean,
it was about trying to assert their control.
It was about trying to pander to a rather troglodyte right-wing faction.
Exactly. By the way, also the Senate today voted down the transportation bill. That's not surprising. They needed to get 60 votes. They got 54 to 42. Also, Jesse Furman, however, finally got confirmed. Application went in and passed, actually, the Senate committee in September, but did not get confirmed as a federal judge till today.
You know, that's great. And what you said before that, the transportation bill got 54 votes in the Senate. That's four more than it needs to pass. And any other time in the history of the United States, that would mean that it would be law or on its way to becoming a law. And today, there must have been a Republican filibuster of it, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
So and it's like we don't even bother to report Republican filibusters anymore because they've become so routine. And that makes me crazy. but not to knock your reporting, Ellen. I mean, it's just this is like right across the board. It's like, oh, it didn't get 60 votes. Well, it didn't get, it shouldn't have to get 60 votes. Anyhow, Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, TalkRadioNews.com, brought to you by Ellen's new book, Self-Empowerment. Ellen, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Great to talk with you. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
The Financial Times is reporting today, this is fascinating, that the United States, China, and India are getting together. There's this big meeting going on where we and India and China are taking one side of this argument. The European Union, 20 EU nations, are taking the other side. The EU right now charges airlines when they fly in or out of European airspace or, countries, they charge them a carbon tax. They have to pay a tax on the carbon that they blew into the atmosphere by flying into those countries, and then that carbon tax is presumably used to reduce carbon dioxide emissions or ameliorate carbon dioxide or deal with global warming. Everybody in Europe understands, hey, global warming is real. In fact, they're very concerned about the consequence, the impact it's going to have on them and their country. And so you've got that on the one hand. And on the other hand, you've got the United States, China, and India saying, oh, wait a minute, we don't want to pay no stinking carbon tax. I find it fascinating. You can see it in the front page of today's Financial Times. Anyhow, it's Anything Goes Friday. Your calls, your thoughts. James in Franklin, Tennessee. Hey, James, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I got a statement I want to say here, Tom, and I'll take my answer off there. Your reply, okay?
Sure.
The government, I think, should set up measures to eliminate the trade deficit. It's running right at $5 billion a year. This alone will create...
It's running at $500 billion a year.
$500 billion a year, excuse me. Hmm. Yes, and it's eliminate, you know, this will eliminate the trade deficit, will raise the GDP by the same amount and produce that much output. And that's
yep.
new workers I'm talking about will be needed. Suppose it costs a business $100,000 to hire a worker. So you divide, you know, $500 billion by $100,000, that's 5 million workers.
Yep.
So eliminating the shortfall will generate 5 million new jobs. At
that's well-paid new jobs, yeah. Yeah, yeah, absolutely right.
That's right.
And absolutely
the
right.
It can be done, yes, sir, and it can be done by setting up low export exchange rates, the way China and other Asian nations have done. But first, the U.S. government has got to realize that this is a problem of balancing our trade.
Yeah. No, I agree with you.
And set up.
Yeah. And no, I'm totally with you, James. Thank you for the call, and thanks for making a very, very cogent and important point. And in fact, let me amplify that. The Republicans are hysterical about the budget deficit, about the fact that we're adding to our national debt. What they don't point out is that we've had a trade deficit that has been floating between $500 and $800 billion a year, every year, for basically since the 90s, since you know, we went into, and perhaps since the 80s. It was either the late 80s or the early 90s when we started having a really substantial trade deficit. We had always historically had a trade surplus. And this trade deficit has gotten so large, it's trillions and trillions of dollars. And the way that it gets paid off, you know, when we borrow, you know, when we owe the world $500 billion, a half a trillion dollars more than we, you know, when we buy half a trillion dollars more worth of stuff than we sell to the rest of the world, then that means that the rest of the world has a half a trillion dollars that they can only spend here in the United States. So what do? Well, they come here and they buy, you know, 100,000 acres of land and build a factory. Or they come here and they buy a building. And, you know, this is why foreign companies and foreign individuals and, you know, foreign wealthy people, they own chunks of Citibank. They own chunks of, you know, large chunks of Manhattan real estate all across the country. All across the country. You're finding everything from water systems to power systems to roads to, you know, being bought by foreign companies. Why? Because our trade deficit is a major economic and national security issue. And frankly, in my opinion, a much more major one than our budget deficit. But the Republicans don't want to talk about the trade deficit. And frankly, neither do the Democrats, because they created it together. Matt in Charlevoix, Michigan. Hey, Matt, what's up?
Yeah, good afternoon, Tom. I don't know if this is beyond your level of expertise or not, but I'm wondering how similar the financial meltdown of Iceland was compared with that of Greece, and what exactly happens. I mean, the Icelanders just decided to renounce the debt.
So far.
What's wrong with that approach, and what happens when you do that? I know Argentina renounced its debt, I think, about a decade ago, and
yeah.
the world didn't come to an end.
In 2000, yeah. I was there in 2001, the year after they had done that, and well, if you were in Argentina at the time, it looked like the world had come to an end. I was staying with a upper middle class family that I was giving a speech down there, and they were sponsoring me, and so I stayed at their home. And a very nice neighborhood of what would be in the United States, you know, in suburban Chicago kind of thing, maybe $300,000-$400,000 homes. And about every third house had in the front yard furniture or TV sets or stereos or things with for sale signs on them and prices. I mean, people were selling things to be able to make their mortgage payments and to be able, because, you know, it just wiped out their economy. On the other hand, once they bounced back from that, Argentina now has one of the highest levels of owner of worker-owned businesses in the world. I mean, they've really reinvented their economy in a very, very healthy and positive way, and they're far more resilient now since they told the IMF to go take a leap. And you know, we'll see where this plays out with Iceland, but so far it looks like they're going to hold off the banksters. And the problem that Greece has is they could do that as if they had their own currency. You know, Iceland has the Icelandic kroner. They have their own currency. But Greece doesn't have their own currency. They don't have the drachma anymore. They're stuck with the euro. And so they can't say, you know, they can't, for example, inflate their currency and say, okay, fine, you know, we owe you a trillion drachmas, here it is. And, you know, which is how the Germans did it, at, you know, after the Treaty of Versailles, when we hit, after World War One, we hit Germany with these very, very punitive paybacks that they had to make to the rest of Europe for the damage of World War One. And so they just inflated their currency like crazy and paid it off in a year, you know, with money that was worth nothing. So none of those options, none of those monetary options are available to Greece right now unless they pull out of the EU, which I think they should do. So it makes sense, Matt?
Well, but the problem is, I mean, if the I understand the problem of them not having their own currency, but if the austerity measures are so draconian, they ruin the economy, they're not going to get paid back, and there's a political element to this, too. I think the Communist Party now is up to about 40% membership in Greece, so this government that they have in power in Greece isn't long for this world.
Yeah, no, you're right. And in fact, the government that they have in Greece, they did have, you know, you had Papandreou, who was the prime minister, and he said, hey, let's hold a referendum like the Icelanders did on whether or not we should pay back this debt. And they bounced him out and replaced him with the former vice president of the European Central Bank, you know, with a bankster, Papandreou, who is now the prime minister. So yeah, spot on, Matt. And this is, and it is radicalizing people in Greece, and they are getting out in the streets. But what you're missing is that this isn't about paying back the debt. Frankly, the rest of Europe, you know, they don't mind if the debt doesn't get paid back. That's not the issue. I mean, you know, the bondholders would like the debt to be paid back, of course, the banksters. But there's a larger issue here, and that is the looting of Greece. That's what's really going on right now. Greece is like Florida to Europe. And you've got, like, Germany, which is sort of like the Ohio to Europe. And, you know, it's kind of gray and it gets really cold in the winter not to knock Ohio. I mean, or Michigan. I mean, I grew up there, right? But it's not Florida, right? And so what's happening is the wealthy Germans and the wealthy, you know, people from the other interior countries in Europe and the northern countries in Europe who have lots of cash, and the companies, you know, associated with them and the banksters associated with them, they're buying Greek public assets. Greece used to own their ports. They're selling them off. They're selling them to several different countries, the Kuwaitis, the Chinese, other companies. And so what's happening is you're seeing the dismantling of Greece. I mean, they're talking about selling off the Colosseum. They're talking about selling off that's Rome. The Acropolis. They're talking about in Athens. They're talking about taking some of the Greek treasures, selling off islands to turn them into resorts for rich Europeans.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's the pillage of Greece. That's what's going on. And this is what Naomi Klein identified in her book about disaster capitalism. You're seeing it writ large in Europe right now. Tom Hartman here, broadcasting from Chicago today, from WCPT, Chicago's Progressive Talk. Rodney in Chicago Heights, you're on the air.
Tom, how you doing? I'm going to give you about 20 seconds to kiss up. I've become a disciple of Tom Hartman and try to get everybody to watch you. That being said,
Thank you, Rodney.
I'm going to try to get to your event tomorrow. Hopefully I get to meet you. But what I called about is that sheet metal worker, or supposed sheet metal worker, complaining that 4% was a lot to pay. And some union brothers
Rodney, if I may, just for people who have no idea what you're talking about, because this is from yesterday, we had a guy call into the show, and he said, my employer is taking 4% out of my paycheck, and I think it's wrong. And I'm like, and he was doing it like, you know, he's some kind of great liberal, you know, and he's really offended that his employer is sticking it to him. And then, you know, he gets to the rest of the story, which is that his employer is a union. And he was like, and I have no choice in this. And it turns out, A, he does have a choice, and B, union dues are tax deductible. I mean,
right. And his employer is not the union. His employer is a contractor that is a union shop.
Right.
But my solution for him, if 4% an hour is too much for him to have union protection, you know, I have a very simple solution for him. He can quit and go to right to work for less state, work for a non-union contractor. He'd be lucky to get the $22 an hour that he's getting now, and he definitely would not get the additional $26 an hour in benefits package.
Yeah, yeah, he could go to work for Walmart. you're absolutely right. Excellent point, Rodney. Thank you very much for the call. Great to hear from you. I appreciate it. Joe in Baltimore. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Oh, hey, thanks. I usually agree with you guys about half the time, but I think that we got two great examples of government overreach. One is, you know, Obama trying to define what religion is, and two.
Wait a minute. When did Obama try to define what religion is?
And two is Virginia.
But Joe, wait a second. When did Obama try to define what religion is?
Well, under the Health Care Act, they're defining what a religious organization, you know, what is a legitimate religious organization or not. That's not really the point. The point is, and then Virginia goes and overreaches.
That's not defining what religion is. That's defining when a religious organization engages in secular work, whether that secular work is, you know, has to compete on a level playing field with everybody else who's doing that secular work in the secular marketplace. The priests and nuns and people who work, you know, who work for actual churches, there has always been an exemption for them. They don't have to give birth control to their employees.
And there was an exemption for religious organizations prior to the Obama administration saying, well, what you just said, that if you have the gall to provide charity
for non-religious organizations who are traditionally secular functions that are owned by religions. I mean, there's a very clear line there, Joe, and that's not redefining religion. That's redefining the tax code and redefining the employer code.
You talk about this issue if you want, but then you have Virginia requiring this medical procedure, which is invasive and
state sanctioned rape.
Is the danger. One is the state level, one is the federal level, of the government getting too much control over health care and all this other kind of stuff. Because there is nothing that would stop the federal government from requiring exactly what Virginia requires. And if the liberals are also in favor of Obamacare, they better be willing to concede that if you get a bunch of Republicans in there who also want to control a lot of stuff, and I'm not a Republican, they will then have the power to do exactly what Virginia has done with respect to abortion.
Joe, and there is a world of difference between saying to an employer, anytime you're using state power, you're using that power. You could say the same thing is true of traffic laws. Power of the state is the power of the state. But there is a world of difference between saying to an employer, you have to provide the same comprehensive set of health services, of healthcare services, and we're not even talking about abortion here. We're talking about birth control. You have to provide the same set of comprehensive services that your peers in the rest of the industry do. There's a difference between that and saying, oh, and by the way, if you want an abortion, you're going to have an agent of the state stick this 9-inch long thing up inside you and move it around to produce an image. That is, in my opinion, state sanctioned rape. And there's
both overreaches of government power into the individual.
Okay, clearly in your mind, Joe, they are. I don't think that an overreach of government to an employer is anything close to the equivalent of the overreach of government into the life of an individual. And
do you think the federal government, if Sebelius or let's say Republican gets elected, and the HHS secretary says, you know what, for abortions, not only do insurance companies have to do this, all employers have to require all insurance companies, in order to cover an abortion, have to have this procedure that Virginia is requiring.
Here is the night and day that you're missing, Joe. On the one hand, on the these are both government powers, but on the one hand, the one is saying to an employer, to a corporation, an ecclesiastical corporation, but a corporation nonetheless, if you're going to play by the rules of business, and we're going to give you all kinds of exemptions and tax-free status and goodies, and your executives, even your religious executives, can write off your three martini lunches. If you're going to play in that game, in that role of business where we give you special privileges, then you're going to have to play by this set of rules. That's a completely different thing than saying to an individual, if you want to have a legal medical procedure, then the state is going to perform an invasive procedure on you. That is night and day, saying, because individuals do not have the ability or the right or whatever it may be to conduct their lives by virtue of the grace of government. Corporations do. Governments confer rights to corporations. People have inherent rights, and government should be limited from overstepping those. That's the difference, Joe. And it's a world of difference. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
29 minutes or 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Anything Goes Friday. Back with more of your calls. Thirty-four minutes past the hour. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Anything Goes Friday from Chicago, and Brian in Bloomington, Illinois. Hey, Brian, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you doing today?
I'm great, but I'll get better, Brian. How about you?
Good. Not bad. I would like to ask your opinion on the upcoming call for a general strike by the Occupy movement on May 1st.
Yeah.
I have done some research on past general strikes. The first of which occurred in the United States was for the 10-hour workday. The second of which was for the eight-hour workday or the 40-hour work week. I am a union member in Bloomington, and I am trying to raise awareness amongst my union members, not only in my union but others. And I was wanting your opinion.
Well, I think that this. First of all, I hadn't heard that there was any consensus among various Occupy movements across the country that there would be a call for a general strike on May 1st. Maybe I missed it. But
this is actually something a topic I have not heard on your program, and I'd like to bring a little awareness to that.
Okay. Which Occupy movement passed this, or which ones have passed this?
The Occupy movement rally that I'm going to in March 15th, I believe it is, in St. Louis, is a regional meeting. I do believe it's to raise awareness of this event. And I believe, as the 99% a working class member of society, that we should do something on a grand scale to speed up some changes that should occur in government.
I think it would be a marvelous thing, Brian, to have a wake-up event and to have a wake-up moment. I don't think that it's going to happen without the assistance of organized labor. And even at that, you know, it's the organized labor is not that large in the United States anymore. It's 70% of the workforce.
It's decreasing by the
But the Occupy movement, while organized labor is 7 or 8%, the Occupy movement is, you know, maybe 0.1%. It's, you know, the people who are actually showing up and participating. And so it's going to take more than.
By no means am I suggesting that, you know, the unions, you know, try and be the forefront of this, merely join in and show our support as working class members, because as you know, if there are no unions in certain states, the wages of everyone goes down. In
sure.
turn, if there are higher wages in that state, then even the people that aren't union get paid.
Right to work for less. Workers in a right to work for less state typically make $5,000 a year less and suffer disability or death in the workplace 51% more frequently.
Absolutely. And
So that's why I'm saying you need to get, or, you know, if the Occupy movement wants to do this, God bless them, but I don't think that they're going to have tremendous success on their own. I think they're going to have to start, building coalitions with existing groups like your union, for example. And good on you, Brian, for talking to the folks in your union. And I would suggest that you try to get the union leadership to bring this up for a vote for everybody and get them involved with it. We'll see where it goes. Brian, thank you for the call and thanks for raising the issue. Karen in Midway, Ohio. Hey, Karen, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just wonder what you think the fallout would be if they started holding congressional hearings about the tax-exempt status of some of these religious organizations and there was absolutely only secular people allowed to testify or be on the board. What fallout would you hear across the country then?
I don't know. I must have missed a couple of words in there because they are holding these hearings.
I'm saying that you're not allowing any women to testify.
Oh, I see.
It's religious and men on the panels.
Yeah.
What would it be if there was a group of secular people that were making the decisions about all the religious organizations and institutions in this country without hearing from them?
Well, that's what the folks who are trying to turn this into an issue are saying, is that basically the secular institution of government is picking winners and losers here or changing the rules of the game or whatever. As I said, I don't view it that way.
Without allowing women a voice.
But here's if you want to ask hypothetical questions that can be used to kind of illustrate what's going on. I think the hypothetical question would be, what if a bunch of women in Congress got together and held hearings where only women were allowed to testify, and the question was, should any man who wants to have Viagra or any erectile dysfunction drug covered by his health insurance plan be forced to go to a urologist and have his penis measured and a prostate exam on top of it, right?
It's
to make sure
same,
that his prostate's in good health and that his apparatus is functional and not
thank
allow
God.
Men to testify about it.
So, thank you. I knew you'd have a retort.
You're welcome, Karen. Thank you very much for the call. I mean, it's just at a certain level you get how absurd this whole thing is. Anyway, Chris in Bellevue. Hey, Chris, what's up in Bellevue, Washington?
Tom, I enjoy your program. Keep up the good work.
Thanks. What's up?
Tom, I want to talk about tax, and I want to contribute to the argument in the following way. Our argument, I think, needs to be that the utility of money is nonlinear, and that utility is what we need to tax. The rich should pay more, not because they can afford it. That's a failed argument. It's going to continue to fail. They should pay more because $1 million, the usefulness of $1 million is more than 10 times the usefulness of $100,000, is more than 10 times the usefulness of $10,000, and so on. Tom, how do you feel about that?
Makes sense. It makes sense, and it sounds like the basis of something like the wealth taxes that were debated at the founding of this country, and that many European countries have had for years and years.
And maybe a modern version of a wealth tax could be a treasury tax for corporations. If you don't spend it, we're going to tax it.
Well, that's. It's very interesting, Chris. You've opened a whole new line of thought in my brain. Let me roll it around a little bit before I go off on it. But very, very interesting point. The thought that occurred to me when you were saying that somebody having $1 million, that $1 million has more than 10 times the utility of somebody having $100,000, was actually the opposite. I was thinking that in terms of utility for society, of benefits for society, 10 people having $100,000 is a greater benefit than one person having $100,000, or $1 million rather. And so that one person who has $1 million should be paying a higher tax on it because that money has actually less utility at the social level. It has more potential political power. It has more, more potential to do mischief and harm, but it has less. It's not going to be spent by maybe a million might, but 10 million or 100 million or 500 million or a billion is not going to be spent by that person, and so it's not going to serve society. It's not going to help the economy. So I think you could argue that from either direction and come to the same to the same conclusion, but it's a fascinating one. Chris, thank you very much for that. Denver in Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, Denver, what's up?
I want to give you kudos for what for your trying to explain to Joe in Chicago to preface my statement about the free trade agreement and Iceland and Argentina finally going back to their own currency to control their own economies.
Yeah.
I saw what was going to come from this, Tom, when I saw the law passed by Clinton. I thought Clinton, you know, did a lot of good things. This was the worst thing that has ever happened.
Well, you can blame it on Bill Clinton, or you could also, Denver, you could blame it on Newt Gingrich, because that was the year that the Republicans took control of Congress, you know, and you brags about that. And what did they give us? NAFTA and the WTO. So it wasn't...
Getting to the subject you were speaking of about taking the tax status from the secular organizations who are under the auspice of Christianity, why don't they instead channel more of their thought towards the mega churches, which are leading people who are seeking after what is right in Christianity, seeking after right what is in Christianity, and having these I call them false prophets, telling them a way to think. I am a liberal-minded person. I think for myself. I see right. But no longer will I speak truth to power. I worked for D.C. long enough, and I spoke truth to power, and it got me in a lot of trouble, I'll be honest with you. But if the world would get away from this free trade agreement, you'd see a great improvement across the country.
Well,
and
most other countries that participate in this have ways to protect their domestic industries. Usually, it's with a VAT tax that they reverse out when they export things, and that they apply when they import things, and so it serves
what
as a tariff.
What it has allowed to do, though, Tom, is allowed these mostly United States multinationals to come in. Cargill, for example, into India, wanting to, impose on India and their seed, this Roundup Ready seed.
Yeah, that's Monsanto. But, yeah, no, I get your point. I get your point, Denver.
And oil companies, et cetera, et cetera.
No, you're absolutely right. We're the ones getting screwed the worst by it. But basically what we're seeing, and your point is very well taken, what we're seeing is the growth of the new international autocrats, the new international plutocrats, the new international oligarchs and their transnational corporations. And their power exceeds that of most governments.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I had an amazing conversation with a cab driver the other day. He said, I used to listen to Christian radio all the time, but now all I want to do is talk about politics.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to our executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producer, Jacob Dean, our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our phone screeners, Paul Edney and Julie Lulley. Paul's running the board today, too. Great work. And our writer-researcher, Sam Sachs, to Alva Goldberg for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, to our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, all the folks at the various organizations that syndicate this program, Pacifica Radio, Dial Global, Free Speech TV on Dish Network and DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Networks, all the others around the country, to Don Rojas and Dennis Trunov and the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV, who work on the big picture, to our newsletter editors, Sue Nethercutt, and all the folks in the chat room. Sorry I couldn't be with you today. Hey, greetings to you all. To Ellen Ratner and Victoria Jones and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you. Back to your calls. Mark Taylor Canfield in Seattle. Hey, Mark, you got an update on Occupy Seattle?
Yes, I do, Tom.
Go for it.
It's been a while.
What we're really excited about the fact that we're having a national Occupy Movement conference. It's happening all of this weekend, Saturday and Sunday, the 18th and 19th. And then actually there's some activities going on Monday for Occupy President's Day, but it's really exciting. There are people from all over the country, from representatives from Occupy groups from all around the country that are going to be there to discuss what is the next step. You know, where are we going to go from here? How are we going to coordinate our national movement? And one of the things I'm particularly interested in is to find out what is the political organization that may come out of this, because I know there's going to be a lot of discussion about the Occupy movement's involvement in the political system itself. I just heard the other day that there's actually an Occupy candidate running somewhere on the East Coast right now as an Occupy candidate. That's the first time I've heard of that, but I won't be surprised to hear more. And I'll be covering it for the Huffington Post and also doing a workshop myself on how to protect your civil rights at protests, which I need to have some experience in.
Okay, great. People can learn more about that at what website?
Go to OSSF.org. That's for the Occupy Solidarity Social Forum, and that's happening in Olympia, Washington, up here in Washington State, and it's going to be going on all weekend. And we're really excited about it. I'm excited to see what happens, and I'll be sure to call in, you know, next week and give you guys an update on what transpired there. But
great.
It's going to be great.
Okay.
I think it's just the first in a series. We've already heard of two other national conferences that are going to be happening starting in March. So it's a good thing.
Mark, good on you. And say give my best to everybody and good luck. Keep us up to date. Thank you very much for the call. Tim in Los Angeles. Hey, FDR put the Japanese in camps. Is that what you wanted to talk about, Tim, really?
Yes. In Executive Order 9066, he forced more than 100,000 Americans from Canada all the way down, well, in the United States, 120,000 Americans and Japanese Americans to concentration camps because he thought, and he had pressure from the, you know, from the businesses, that Japanese and Japanese Americans were spies because of, after what happened at Pearl Harbor.
Right.
I mean,
yeah, and what this demonstrates to me is that pretty much anybody is... Nobody's perfect, and anybody is vulnerable to fear if the fear is great enough. And FDR, this is a horrible mistake that FDR made.
And it's happening again today with NDAs and definite intention. But this time it isn't just Japanese Americans. It could happen to anybody. But another reason why I'm calling is because I don't know if you would allow me to do this, but we're going to have what they call a Day of Remembrance in Little Tokyo, Los Angeles. Is it okay if I plug it?
Nice. Sure. Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. The service is called Day of Remembrance, 70 years after Executive Order 9066, Defending Our Civil Liberties. It is at 369 East 1st Street in Los Angeles, California, from 2 to 4 p.m. It's free at the Japanese American National Museums. And if you would like more information about the service, you could go to tinyurl.com/NCRR. And we're going to have a service remembering what Roosevelt did. And I'm sure we're going to talk about NDAA and how it'll affect not just me as a Japanese American, but you too, Tom, as a white American.
Yeah, it affects us all in two ways, Tim. One, you know, the classic John Donne, you know, for whom the bell tolls. Any man's death diminishes me, for I'm involved in mankind. Any destruction of individual rights hurts all of us. But it also, as you correctly point out, this doctrine of any government having the power to indefinitely detain somebody, to kill somebody without a trial, an American citizen or not, frankly, these are powers that should not be given to our government, that no government should have. And we're quite a ways down that road right now. And George Bush just put us on steroids. You know, he shot us halfway to the moon on this thing. And Obama has walked back some of this stuff, and good on him for that, and doesn't use the phrase war on terror and doesn't use the scare stuff like the Bush administration did. But he still has a ways to go also. And
when President Obama signed the bill, I was like, oh, my gosh, not again.
Yeah. You're talking about the Defense Authorization Act. Yeah.
Yes. And I was like crying because of that, and I don't cry that easily.
Yeah.
And it just scared the hell out of me because what my father went through as a child, am I going to have to go through that too again?
Yeah. Well, let us hope not, Tim, and let us acknowledge that the Muslims of today are the Japanese of your father's generation, and that in both cases, hysteria and fear and racism run rampant are a cancer in this country. And thanks for the heads up on the memorial, on the remembrance there in L.A. Tim, I wish you well. Thank you for the call. And thanks for listening to K-Talk, by the way. So we'll be back on Monday. And until then, don't forget, democracy begins with you. When you get out there, when you show up, occupy something. Occupying the airwaves, Tom Hartman here with you. We'll see you on Monday. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.